271-352-6-5738. In reply, you'll get a link that'll help you donate to the station. We hope that you'll join us, and thank you.
KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community station, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
You may remember we had an election on May 7th. Mm-hmm. So if you want the results, you can go to harrisvotes.com or go to your local election clerk page and you can find the results there. The only one I had on my ballot was the constitutional amendments, which I assumed would pass because they mentioned tax deduction or tax, what do they call it?
Reduction.
Not reduction.
Tax cuts.
All right. We're both going to do this, right? It's not a waiver. It's not a deduction. It's an exemption. That's what
exemption.
Because they both had tax exemptions. And even if people don't know if they qualify, they're going to vote for it anyhow. Yeah. So, of course, they passed with like 80%. But I did recommend voting against them. And actually, we'll talk about that later in the show. Also, remember, we have another election coming up on May 24th, primary runoff and precinct chair election. First day of early voting is the 16th, which I think is Monday. Is that Monday? Mm-hmm. I think it's Monday. First day of early voting is the 16th. If you are doing mail-in ballots, you should have yours by now. So if you don't, call your election person and make sure that it's been sent. And if not, they might have to send you another one. Hmm. Okay, so the first story from communityimpact.com. The League City City Council, I'm just getting used to that now. The League City City Council postpones a vote on pigs as pets. You're going to be wondering, why am I bothering with this story? There's always a greater context. On May 10th, League City City Council voted to postpone a decision on whether to allow residents to keep pigs as pets. On April 26th, City Council passed the first reading of an ordinance update to allow residents to keep pigs as pets. It requires the approval of a second reading to go into effect. This is often what happens when you have a unicameral house. Under the ordinance, pigs would have to be vaccinated, spayed, or neutered, and registered with the city. Additionally, and this is one of the punchlines, there would be no size restrictions for the pigs, meaning residents could keep pigs that grow to hundreds of pounds in their homes. Pigs grow pretty much as long as they're alive. Pigs would also have to remain collared, try to get that at PetSmart, and stay indoors except for exercise or elimination of waste, delicately stated. Outdoor areas where pigs go would have to be cleaned daily, according to the ordinance. That's actually pretty generous, as opposed to each time they eliminate waste. Several residents spoke in opposition to allowing pigs as pets, citing concerns about pigs' noise, size, aggression, and other issues. Now, of course, in any case, these would be some kind of domesticated pig. Pigs are aggressive, but not as aggressive as the wild type. Police Chief Gary Ratliff sent council members a letter outlining concerns with the ordinance. Council member Larry Milliken said, His concerns were not discussed at the meeting, but Ratliff did discover other cities that allow pigs as pets do have several restrictions in place, Mayor Pat Hollacy said. Council member Nick Long said he is not opposed to size restrictions on pigs. In addition, he said he does not see the point of the ordinance requiring pigs to be registered with the city when residents don't need to register their guns. So apparently we have a right to bear pigs. Council member Hank Doogie, if any of these names sound familiar, it's because we've talked about them before. Council member Hank Doogie said he agrees with removing the registration requirement. Long also requested the ordinance clearly states that it does not trump, and that's a word now that we're going to have to think about, it does not trump homeowners association restrictions regarding pets or animals or deed restrictions that may prevent residents from specifically keeping pigs as pets in certain neighborhoods. The vote to postpone passed 5-3 with council members Doogie, John Bowen, and Chad Tressler opposed. It will be brought before council again at a later date after city staff makes changes to the proposed ordinance. Now, first of all, it's amazing how often we talk about the League City Council. I guess it's just a place with characters. There's a little more going on here besides domesticated pigs being kept as household pets. First, there's council member Nick Long, who's not opposed to size restrictions on pigs, which can grow to a quarter of a ton or more. And he does not see the point of requiring pigs to be registered because, hey, we don't register guns. Can you pull the trigger on your pig? If not, perhaps it should be registered. So is the argument here that the Constitution not only guarantees the right to bear arms, but to bear pigs? It's kind of nice the ordinance doesn't require that it supersedes HOAs on animal ownership, and I have nothing against pigs. Everything I've read about pigs is that they're disturbingly intelligent, as a matter of fact, as food animals. They're perfectly capable of forming bonds with their owners, but they don't stop growing. Now, for some reason, we find ourselves, as I said, talking about League City a lot. I'm not sure why that is. Now, we don't know the party affiliations of the pro and con pig groups, but it sounds from the Association of Pigs with the Second Amendment right to bear arms like what we have is, I don't know, about whether the pro-pig registration faction is Democratic or just like more moderate Republican in the sense we used to understand, because it's supposed to be a nonpartisan city council. But obviously the anti-pig registration faction is almost certainly a libertarian bunch. So it's like if you're not going to register guns, you shouldn't register anything. So again, the slippery slope. And if you're not going to forbid the ownership of guns, you shouldn't forbid the ownership of anything. Now, there are like dwarf horses that some people on like farms and acreage that they keep as pets. There are people that have miniature pigs that don't grow to be much more than 30 or 40 pounds as pets. But it seems like the direction that this is going, I'm sure we'll be discussing the League City Council again, possibly on pigs. Andrew?
Well, I am generally in favor of expanding the options that homeowners have for keeping various kinds of pets, because there are a lot of places that don't allow people to have chickens in their yard, for example. And chickens are the kind of pet where it is actually useful to have them because you can get a fresh supply of food from them. They, you know, lay eggs regularly, and you can, you know, have fresh eggs every morning.
And there's also the alarm clock matter.
There is that too.
Which won't make you friends with
which won't make you friends, but may help you get up for work on time.
Or in my case, tell me when to go to sleep.
That too. So I think that, you know, there is, I like the idea of letting people have more options when it comes to what animals they can keep. But I can see the argument that maybe this particular amendment is not fully thought out. I'm not familiar enough with pigs, really, to be able to confidently say that, you know, they're too large to be kept in urban environments. But it would make sense, I think. You know, because some of these houses can have pretty small yards. And
well, I think that there are just some animals that if you, you know, like a horse, I like horses. I've met horses. I've been friendly with horses, but I wouldn't keep them in my subdivision.
Yeah.
Like if there are certain animals, if you want them as pets, that's swell for you. But then you have to get yourself some acreage.
Yeah, you need to give them enough space where they can roam.
And your neighbors enough space so that you're not constantly bothering.
Yeah, so that they're...
Because remember, you don't have to register your guns.
Yeah, you need to make sure that your pigs aren't trying to eat through the neighbor's fence. And
or perhaps use your gun, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so our next story from communityimpact.com. Incumbents unseated in Harris County ESD, and we'll talk about what that is, election. So three challengers will serve four-year terms as commissioners for Harris County Emergency Services District, ESD number 9. All three incumbents were unseated. Here's the reason I picked this story. The three victorious challenges earned, respectively, 20.7% for the first winner, 18.9% for the first runner-up, and 17.7% for the second runner-up. A total of 10,787 total votes were counted as of May 7th, but that's kind of irrelevant. Just because it's under 11,000 votes in a relatively small election in an absolute sense, and I have no idea what the party affiliations or political positions are of any of these winners or losers, but I have real issues with anyone winning any public office with, well, less than 50% of the vote, for starters. I mean, to have the top vote getter that beat the incumbent get 20.7%. I mean, this is an obvious reason to have either ranked choice voting or runoffs requiring at least 50% plus one. There is no way that you can say that any of these people have any kind of electoral mandate.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, ranked choice voting would be, I think, advantageous in this particular position because from these totals, I would imagine that this was basically just a list of everybody who was running for the entire district board, and the top, you know, three vote getters would take the three seats that were available. And right. That is the kind of election where ranked choice voting is perfect for, because yes, it does allow people who are running for those kinds of positions to get that majority of the vote. Whereas in a first past the post election, which is what we have currently in place, the winners of those elections cannot get more than 50% of the vote as long as there are more than two people running. So, you know, it is absolutely the perfect kind of election for this to happen. It does bother me, though.
And I just want to insert before I forget, because it already left my head twice, that you want to make sure that you don't have a process that allows stalking horses to be set up to take 1% of the vote here and 0.5% of the vote there, so that certain individuals that are a little better financed, a little better known, then can essentially skim the election. And this has been known to happen. It happens in Houston politics all the time.
Right. And I know that you mentioned that, you know, the size of the total votes was not as big of an issue here. But I agree it's not as big of an issue, but I think it's an issue worth looking at, because really only about 10,000, only about 11,000 people voted in this election. That's, come on. There's got
to
be more
people. I would be willing to bet that that represents somewhere between 10 and 20% of the eligible electorate, because this kind of an election, that's about what you get.
Yeah. And it's ridiculous that it's ridiculous that people are not bothering to participate in local elections when the local elections have far more of an impact on their daily lives than the big elections, the big publicized elections do.
That's what we both keep saying, and I guess we'll say it until somebody's listening.
And I wonder if there needs to be some sort of voter resource that basically lets you find a local decision that you don't like, figure out who was responsible for it, what office they hold, and what other options you may have when that office comes up to election. Because I think if there was some sort of way to connect people's complaints with the idea of, okay, let's vote somebody else in, then we might see a boost in local election participation.
Well, technically, when they are following the law, all elected officials are in almost every location in every government position in the United States where there's a group, they're supposed to have an open meeting.
Yes.
They're not supposed to have like closed door meetings unless it's some kind of really significantly special situation. So like if you want to know what your city council is doing, even if it's the League City Council, typically you can go to the council website and they'll have all the motions and such moved this and such and the problem is it's very dry for the average person.
Yeah,
it's hard to get past the first quarter of a page,
and you
which is why activists matter.
Yeah.
And why activists being able to obtain some measure of public voice. And I guess this is what those kinds of people can be better at than average.
But I think there's
a pyramid of ways to learn about this stuff, but it takes someone being interested enough to tell two people, so they tell two people, and so on, as the Pearl commercial used to go.
Yeah, and you have to sift through a lot of these documents, which I think that's sort of the difference between this idea that I'm putting forward, is having a database where, you know, people collect this information, put it into a searchable database, and then you can go, I didn't like that my tax rate was dropped, you know, by...
Ballotpedia is not bad about that kind of stuff. And I would like to think that this show serves something of that purpose as well.
Yeah.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., online on kpft.org during airtime, or you can podcast it, which I suggest, or you can go to archive.kpft.org to listen to older episodes of this or about 100 other shows on KPFT. Every show, every story rather, on the show is heavily excerpted, so I link to the full articles. I don't know anyone else that does this. You basically get my script on my blog post. Click on show posts or more, go to the top of the webpage. ThinkWingRadio.com is the site. Find the post for the show or the show date. You can type keywords into the search bar. I've got like 10 years of shows on there, so there's a lot to search through, but there's text, so it's searchable. We're on social media for questions, comments, and suggestions. Check for Facebook at our Facebook page. It's okay, folks. It's just late. Check our Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I do. I'm at Dominate I on Twitter, Tumblr, and on Twitch, where I play games, talk far left politics, and make stupid jokes. That's Dominate EYE on Twitter, Tumblr, and Twitch.
Our next story is from TexasTribune.org. Austin becomes the first Texas city to test a taxpayer-funded guaranteed income program. Austin will be the first major Texas city to use local tax dollars to give cash to low-income families to keep them housed as the cost of living skyrockets in Austin. Under a year-long $1 million pilot program that cleared a key Austin City Council vote Thursday, the city will send monthly checks of $1,000 to 85 needy households at risk of losing their homes, an attempt to insulate low-income residents from Austin's increasingly expensive housing market and prevent more people from becoming homeless. Mayor Steve Adler said at a press conference, "We can find people moments before they end up on our streets and prevent them, divert them from being there." That would be not only wonderful for them, but it would be a wise and smart way for the taxpayers in the city of Austin, because it will be a lot less expensive to divert someone from homelessness than to help them find a home once they're on the streets. Eight Austin City Council members voted Thursday to establish the Guaranteed Income Pilot Program and contract with a California nonprofit to run it. Austin joins at least 28 U.S. cities, such as Los Angeles, Chicago, and Pittsburgh, that have tried some form of guaranteed income. Locally, the idea came out of efforts to rework how the city tackles public safety in the wake of protests over police brutality in 2020. Preliminary findings from a similar pilot program showed some promising results. Up Together, the California nonprofit that will run the Austin program, ran a separate guaranteed income program funded by private dollars in Austin and Georgetown that ended in March, the nonprofit said in a statement Thursday. That program gave 173 families $1,000 a month for a year, and the nonprofit said participants used the money for expenses like rent and mortgage payments, child care, fuel, and groceries. Some were able to boost their savings. More than half of recipients slashed their debt by 75%, and more than a third eliminated household debt, the nonprofit said. Debt is the sponge that keeps the poor poor. This has been tried in a number of cities, in some states, in several countries. I think it's been tried in Sweden and maybe Norway and maybe Iceland. And I guess the fact that it's not widespread is partly political, philosophical, and partly because it's the statistics are probably really hard to parse. But, you know, when you consider that the rich get rich when people spend money, and that it only makes sense that poor people that have money spend pretty much all their money, most of it certainly, and eventually that works its way up through the economy. It's not trickle down, it's bubble up, and then eventually, you know, the buck stops at the oligarchs. Andrew?
Well, this story really made me think about my hang-ups with the idea of a basic income, because I should preface this by saying I would very much like a basic income program to work. I have no objections to the core idea of providing people with the resources that they need to live, obviously, if you've listened to me talk for more than 10 minutes. But the thing that concerns me with a lot of universal basic income or guaranteed income or whatever you want to call it programs is that I don't see a way to prevent them from essentially becoming useless. And the way that I think that happens is, or could happen, is I usually don't see any kind of law that says, you know, landlords cannot immediately raise rent by $1,000. Bosses cannot immediately deduct pay by $1,000 or however much the basic income is. Utilities cannot immediately go up by $1,000. You know, all these sorts of things. I think that a successful basic income program would need to be implemented along with some sort of rent control, utility price control, and an increase in minimum wage in order to ensure that essentially the money from the basic income program doesn't just go directly to the people who are already putting people into debt.
Well, I think, if I may, I think, first of all, I was half expecting you to say it might make people lazy, which would have just floored me to the left of you. No, I know that. But I think the key here is that landlords and utility companies, et cetera, don't have to even know that you're receiving this money. For example, when you apply for an apartment or when you apply for a credit card, it might, the application might say, if you wish to apply it toward this apartment for income purposes, you may, if you wish, add alimony or child support, but you don't have to. Or when you apply for certain things, it might actually say you can't actually mention any of those things. So I think that the simplest way to do it would be you don't have to tell anybody you're receiving this money. And that pretty much solves that problem.
I think it would if it was an elective program, but a lot of these basic income programs want it to be money that everyone gets, regardless of, you know, what their current employment status is or anything. Because the idea is to essentially provide them a safety net if they lose their job. If they
means tested is what you're talking about. But that is,
yeah.
I mean, I understand your concern. And of course, means testing itself can get a little wonky.
Yeah.
But I think one of the interesting things about the Austin program is they're looking at people that are either being evicted or foreclosed.
Yeah.
So those people, there's no question that they have a need.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
So essentially the means test is you're about to be on the street.
Yeah. Okay. I think, yeah, for programs like this that have specific requirements and are, you know, for specific use cases, that I'm more comfortable with that because I think that there's less chance of essentially people getting cheated out of the help they're supposed to receive. Because I think the problem
and,
with
a universal, from a conservative standpoint is that people don't abuse it. And of course, almost every one of these studies shows that at least so far statistically abuse is very, very limited, which is not to say government programs aren't abused.
But it's negligible in its impact.
In this kind of program, unless you simply have like the equivalent of spam applications that aren't sufficiently vetted.
Yeah.
At least in these programs where they've carefully screened, generally they don't stay home eating popcorn, watching TV. They pay bills. They pay debts. They pay rent. They buy clothes. and all the merchants that they go to benefit from it. So this, essentially, the public entity gets its money back one way or another, whether it's jobs or tax revenue or property appreciation or whatever it happens to be. Mm. Okay, we're going to do a kind of a block of three stories. They kind of become a theme. The first one is from Charles Kuffner, offthecuff.com. I have started following him more often. I'd forgotten for a while because I have so many home pages that I go to. But yeah, offthecuff.com, definitely go there. His caption for this story is, Abbott sees another opportunity to hurt children. And then he goes on to say he is definitely making this a habit. And he cites a HoustonChronicle.com story. It's linked. Governor Greg Abbott wants to resurrect a court challenge over a 1975 Texas law withholding state funds from school districts for kids who were not legally admitted into the United States. That law was struck down by the Supreme Court in 1982. Kind of like forum shopping, except it takes decades. He made the remarks in an interview Wednesday on the Joe Pags radio show. He said the challenges put on our public systems is extraordinary, he said before referencing Plyler v. Doe, the ruling that overturned the prior Texas law. Abbott went on, I think that we will resurrect that case and challenge this issue again because the expenses are extraordinary and the times are different than when Plyler v. Doe was issued many years ago, meaning we have a lot more conservative judges now and we think we can do the equivalent of forum shopping. But I digress. In that case, the court noted that, quote, education has a fundamental role in maintaining the fabric of our society, and withholding it from children of immigrants in the country without paperwork does not comport with fundamental conceptions of justice. People living without documentation in the country remain people, quote, in any ordinary sense of the term, and are thus entitled to the same basic rights as anyone else in the country. We're going to see a lot more of this, Kuffner goes on, because people like Abbott have realized that SCOTUS is now a cheat code for achieving whatever policy ends they want without having to legislate them. They could say that the policy he seeks to achieve here is the reversal of one that had been done via the court and not the legislative process. The difference is that the litigants in the Plyler case had to win on the merits and could have lost. They didn't get to count on having a majority on the court that was ideologically on their side and willing to use their power towards that end. Okay, we have a couple more parts of that that we're going to talk about after this break. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can listen online at kpft.org or podcast it, which is my suggestion, or you can go to archive.kpft.org to listen to older episodes of this and about 100 other shows from KPFT. KPFT is Houston's community station. And that means we need community support to keep on giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage, hit the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, may qualify you for a lovely thank you gift. Or you can let us keep the thank you gift, and then more of your donation goes to help KPFT, and more of it is tax deductible. Also, remember, word of mouth matters. Spreading the word, standing in line, chatting with friends. You have some favorite show or shows on KPFT, mention them. Maybe your friends will like them too. And that helps us build our listener base and is, frankly, a great assist. Okay, our next story, and you're going to hear the relation here. From the Texas Tribune, Governor Greg Abbott voices clear support for school voucher programs. Abbott said he supports giving parents the option to attend private school. He says we can fully fund public schools while also giving parents a choice about which school is right for their child. He said this during a campaign event in San Antonio. Empowering parents means giving them the choice to send their children to any public, charter, or private school with state funding following the student. Abbott has long been a supporter of the broad concept of school choice, but his focus on it has ebbed and flowed throughout his governorship. His commitment to the cause was thrown into question by a recent string of endorsements in Texas House primary runoffs in which he backed Republicans opposed by school choice proponents, including U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. Critics of vouchers say they hurt public schools, an argument that Abbott's Democratic challenger Beto O'Rourke quickly made after the governor's remarks. O'Rourke said Abbott is for defunding our public schools. Nice turn of phrase. This is a tweet. I'm for fully funding our kids' classrooms and fully supporting parents, teachers, and students. Abbott held the event as part of a focus on, quote, parental rights in his election campaign. Echoing Republicans nationwide, he has vowed, this is great, Abbott has vowed to give Texas parents more say in their kids' education, including over the curriculum they are taught and the types of schools they can attend. Of course, nothing that will hurt their feelings. The Association of Texas Professional Educators said Abbott was again attempting to capitalize on trendy political rhetoric by mislabeling vouchers as a parental right and again ignoring the facts. Texas voters support Texas public schools. Vouchers have long been a tough sell in the Texas legislature, where the idea tends to draw bipartisan opposition in the House, partly from rural Republicans concerned about the health of public schools in their districts. The House Speaker, Beaumont Republican Dade Phelan, said in a recent radio interview that he has no problem with an up or down vote on school choice issues, but noted test votes have previously failed by wide margins. So Abbott said, we can fully fund public schools while also giving parents a choice about which school is right for their child, I think in a part of the story I didn't cite here. And he said this just about the time that the Texas legislature passed and the voters approved recently a statewide cap on local government's ability to fund schools through property taxes in a state that also prohibits any kind of income tax and also wants to essentially give money to public and private and charter schools. So how close is Texas to being able to drown Texas public education in a bathtub about now? Our next story, and what I consider a triplet, is also from the Texas Tribune. Texas Republicans say if Roe falls, they'll focus on adoptions and preventing women from seeking abortions elsewhere. So I guess what does that mean? A pregnancy test at the Texas border? But we'll see. Let's see what the story says. Some of the more conservative members of the Texas House said they also want to ensure strict enforcement of the abortion ban and to prevent pregnant Texans. I like the gender neutral term. Pregnant Texans from seeking legal abortions in other states, said Briscoe Kane, Republican of Deer Park, a member of the, and I love this name, Freedom Caucus. Freedom Caucus is kind of like a people's republic, right? If you didn't say it, you wouldn't know. Anyway, so Kane said, I think I can speak for myself and other colleagues that align with my policy beliefs. We'll continue to do our best, continue to do our best, remember that phrase, to make abortion not just outlawed, but unthinkable. Kane said he has particular interest in going after abortion funds, which seek contributions from donors to help defray the cost of out-of-state trips for pregnant Texans to receive the procedure, citing a state law that prohibits, quote, furnishing the means for procuring an abortion. In a March letter to one such group, the Lilith Fund, Kane threatened to file a bill in the coming legislative session that would empower district attorneys to prosecute abortion-related crimes across the state, even when local authorities refuse to do so, because there have been some county attorneys that have said they wouldn't prosecute it. Governor Greg Abbott did not respond to questions from the Texas Tribune about abortion-related legislative priorities for the coming session in January. House Speaker Dade Phelan said in a statement that he was confident the legislature would, quote, rise to the occasion and redouble our commitment to maternal health care in our state. Redouble, like from one to two? Anyway, State Senator Brian Hughes, Republican Mineola, the author of SB 8, did not respond. He posted on Twitter on Thursday that Texas would, quote, lead the way in a post-Roe world. Be horrified. Other Republican lawmakers spoke about pitching non-punitive measures in the upcoming legislative session. Toth said that if abortion is outlawed in the state, Republicans in the state house will focus on expanding social programs to help pregnant women and their children. This from the politicians who still don't have Medicaid expansion in Texas. So sure, I take their word for it. Republicans have good reason to avoid discussing enforcing Texas's pre-Roe laws, said Renee Cross of the Hobby School of Public Affairs at UH. A full abortion ban is broadly unpopular with voters. Just 15% of respondents in a University of Texas Austin poll released this week said they support prohibiting all abortions. More troubling for Abbott's reelection bid this year, Cross said, is the fact that a majority of independents said they believe abortion should be available in most circumstances. So, Texas is going to redouble its commitment to maternal health care in our state. I think we have one of the higher maternal fatality rates in the country.
Yeah, so, I heard that and so, I was going...
So
yeah,
redoubling going to, that commitment...
Yeah, they're going to double zero and yeah.
Yeah. I also suppose, these are my words, that the usually generous sarcasm alert Texas government will do at this same time, it'll fund fully Texas public education, while state education funding follows the student to charter and private schools, while also capping the taxing authority of local governments to raise taxes to fully fund public education. Because only people who can afford to send their kids to school should get to send their kids to private or charter schools that cost money. Hmm. And that money taken out of the public school system basically impacts on the civics knowledge of everyone in the state, in the country, ultimately.
Yeah.
I mean, public education, the point of public education, cynically, it's to train workers.
Yes.
But democratically speaking, in a small d, public education is to prepare people to be capable citizens. The slogan of the show, an educated electorate, is a prerequisite for democracy. It's the same reason that you even want illegal immigrants to be educated, because otherwise they become a subclass. They become antisocial. They begin to commit antisocial acts, perhaps crime. If they go back to their home country after receiving an American education, hopefully they'll bring positive values that they have learned to their country, share it with people in their country. Hopefully, you know, everyone will benefit from something like that.
Well, the policy here, I think, is in line with what Republicans' ethos has been, to reduce the spending of government until all you have left of government is crime, the legislature, and punishment, the police and the courts. And speaking of the courts, I think that there is another thread through these stories of the government of Texas trying to walk back legal court decisions that they don't like, that that essentially provided for changes to the law that they don't that are not consistent with their ethos of drowning government in a bathtub. I think that this is one of the risks of having relying on court decisions rather than legislation. There was a politics and government course I took when I was in high school in the UK, and we had a sort of module about whether judges should purely interpret the law and make decisions based on the law, or make decisions based off of what they thought was right and wrong, their own judgment. And well, you know, you can have the debate about the merits of each approach, but I think one of the risks of having the approach of relying on judgeship legislation essentially is that those decisions can be reversed, especially if a government like Texas manages to stack the court in its favor. So.
Well, conservatism is the purest form of originalism, because if you're really, really conservative, nothing ever changes. So yeah. 240 years, let's go back.
Mm.
Of course, again, slippery slope. But anyway. Next story is from Texas Tribune. A minor trespassing case gives Governor Greg Abbott's border initiative its first courtroom win. Lester Hidalgo Aguilar, a Honduran migrant, was the first migrant to stand trial in Governor Greg Abbott's Catch and Jail initiative under Operation Lone Star, a multi-billion-dollar border security crackdown launched last March in response to a sharp rise in illegal immigration. And if you think about it, we've talked about this over several shows. In an attempt to deter border crossing, state police have arrested more than 3,000 men in Kinney County on trespassing charges, not illegally crossing the border, mind you, since July. The county accounts for the vast majority of Operation Lone Star's trespassing arrests, with migrants typically picked up on its many hunting ranches or at a remote rail yard. The mass arrests funneled through the court system of a town used to handling a few dozen misdemeanors a year caused a litany of problems. Errors and delays by the local prosecutor and judge have led to illegal detentions, and the trespassing initiative has led to constitutional challenges in both state and federal courts. Other pieces of Operation Lone Star have also faced criticism from Republicans and Democrats alike over deaths of Texas National Guard members and its ever-increasing price tag. With the operation's increasing backlash, as well as continuously rising levels of immigration, securing a conviction out of the first jury trial of the trespassing arrests wasn't necessarily about Aguilar. It was a win the state and the county needed. Out of Kinney County's more than 3,100 reported trespassing arrests through April, 860 men pleaded guilty, typically after spending weeks or months in prison before their first court appearance. But Aguilar's was the first trespassing case to go to trial, and the county wasn't taking any chances. Six jurors, all of whom had Spanish surnames, found Aguilar guilty of trespassing on a fenced ranch land Monday evening after deliberating for less than 20 minutes. After the jury was discharged, the Honduran national told the court that he was brought to the U.S. by his family when he was six and raised in Florida. After a stint in jail in his early 20s, he said he was given the choice of voluntarily going back to Honduras or extended probation, and he left. There, Aguilar said, he became a family man, eventually fathering five children. But he was forced to flee from political prosecution about 5 years ago, he said, and sought asylum in Mexico. He was trying to stay in Mexico for 5 years to gain citizenship so he could more easily apply for a visa in the United States, he said. But he fled to Texas after 4 years because he was being targeted by cartels. While the judge weighed an appropriate jail sentence for his conviction, Aguilar showed what he said was a machete-inflicted scar on his forehead. He raised his hands to reveal only nine fingers, explaining his pinky was taken when he was kidnapped and tortured by cartel operatives. State District Judge Roland Andrade gave Aguilar the maximum punishment for trespassing, 1 year in jail. But against the wishes of the three prosecutors on the bench, Andrade declined to issue an accompanying fine, the maximum of which would be $4,000. Aguilar's court-appointed defense attorney Brian Owens assured the court that whenever Aguilar is released, the end result will be the same. After a costly imprisonment and extensive trial procedure, he said the Honduran migrant will be deported. So, yeah, this is another perfect example of the Republican-run government of Texas being just full of empathy and generosity for education and children and moms and humans generally. Trust them, because in Texas, the cruelty of the government is the point. Andrew?
Absolutely. And this is further evidence that really what the Republicans want government to be is crime and punishment. And they don't mind manipulating the punishment to get there.
And it's like he's in jail for 8 months. I don't know if I included this excerpt in the story. He was in jail for 8 months because he couldn't make a $1,500 bail.
Yeah.
What did the state prosecutors think they were going to accomplish with a $4,000 fine?
Right. And now after a year in jail, he's just going to be deported anyway. Like, this is a total absence of empathy.
Well, again, these are excerpted stories. He is probably going to get 8 months served. So he'll probably end up spending about another 4 months in jail, and then he'll be deported.
Mm.
Whether he gets deported to Honduras or Mexico, I guess, is something for the two countries to fight over. I mean, it's just cruel.
Yeah.
What is the expression? Justice delayed is justice denied. And this is partly a result of having immigration law not be under the Department of Justice.
Mm.
It doesn't have to subscribe to the same rules of evidence or understanding or individual versus group trials. We've actually talked about this a number of times over the past year or so. Okay, you are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, Houston's community station, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. KPFT depends on your financial support to keep bringing you Think Wing Radio and over 100 other unique shows. Your dollars pay for transmitter and equipment costs, programs like Think Wing Radio, Politics Done Right, and other progressive talk shows and a great many music programs. It pays for KPFT's online streaming and the kind of music programs that really you can find nowhere else in Metro Houston. It's local, it's metro, it's regional, it's Idaho, it's Irish. I mean, just it's really an amazing combination. So each time you turn on the radio, you can hear your dollars at work. Make your contribution to the station right now calling 713-526-5738 or go online at kpft.org. So it's either online or call 713-526-5738. Someone will pick up the phone, take you through your options, ask you how much you would like to donate, whether you would like a thank you gift if you qualify for that. But please, if actually, unless it's something you really want, let the thank you gift ride. It's more of a tax deduction for you, and it's more support for KPFT. And remember, each time you turn on the radio, you can hear your dollars at work. Contribute what you can. Please pick the show you're supporting, and no amount is too large or too small, and it's all tax deductible. Okay, our next story is actually several weeks old, but it's from thewashingtonmonthly.com. It was basically found by off the cuff, Charles Kuffner, and it's entitled, Trump's handling of the 2020 census was even worse than you think. The Commerce Department official who oversaw the 2000 census explains how minorities got undercounted and white people overcounted. Donald Trump's most consequential legacy might be the debate he spurred about whether our democracy truly includes everyone. That's also the issue in the Trump administration's hobbling of the 2020 census and how it distorted the current apportionment of the House of Representatives. The large-scale errors in the census cost New York, Texas, Florida, Arizona, California, and New York one seat each, which resulted in an extra representative in Minnesota, Pennsylvania, Oregon, Montana, Wisconsin, and Indiana. You may recall that then Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross's ham-handed scheme to include a citizenship question status on the census was a ploy to depress minority participation and was batted down by the Supreme Court. But the bigger scandal was the census's persistent funding shortfalls, understaffing, and truncated counting schedule. The result was the most error-riddled count in decades. The undercounting of blacks and Hispanics and the double counting of whites and Asians altered the allocation of congressional seats for the next decade. Those wide-ranging errors are matters of public record because the professionals at the Census Bureau obligingly report the decennial census undercount and overcount rates by race and ethnicity. Compared to 2010, undercounts in 2020 jumped from 2.06 to 3.3% for blacks, 1.5 to 5% in Hispanics, 0.15 to 0.9% for Native Americans on reservations and Alaskan Natives. Overcounts also shot up, increasing from 0.8 to 1.64% for whites and from virtually zero to 2.62% for Asians. These substantial errors skew the apportionment of seats in the House because the racial and ethnic makeups of the states vary so widely. The share of black residents by state in 2019 ranged from less than 2% in Montana, New Hampshire, New Mexico, and nine other states to more than 30% in Maryland, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Georgia. Similarly, Hispanics accounted for less than 3% of those living in Maine, Mississippi, and two other states, compared to between 27 and 50% of residents in Florida, Arizona, California, Nevada, and New Mexico. In much the same way, overcounts tend to be concentrated among two groups, non-Hispanic whites and Asians. The share of white residents by state ranged in 2019 from 36% in California and New Mexico to 92% in Vermont and West Virginia. Similarly, Asians comprise less than 2% in Mississippi and Wyoming and West Virginia and 13 other states, compared to 9% in New York, Nevada, and 10% in New Jersey, 15% in California, and 39% in Hawaii. By applying the 2020 error rates to each state's racial and ethnic makeup, we find that undercounts in the 2020 census deprived six states of a congressional seat. Correspondingly, overcounts of white and Asian residents enabled six other states to gain one seat than their populations warranted. The effort by Trump officials to hobble the census did not involve overt manipulation of the results. Instead, they simply withheld the means to avoid serious errors. Officials in the Trump administration may or may not have conspired to use the 2020 census to shift seats in Congress based on states' racial and ethnic makeup, but that was the inescapable effect of their debasement of its operations. The outcome is also consistent with the GOP's implicit and sometimes explicit consensus that power and legitimacy in America are inseparable from race and ethnicity. The view is simply incompatible with democracy. And I did do some checking. As near as I can tell, no lawsuits related to the census to this point have had any effect on actual congressional apportionment. I've also got four different reference links that you can look at if you're interested in pursuing this story further. Andrew?
So sort of to kind of establish some of the base, you know, vocabulary here. And it's all right if you, you know, I don't know how well read you are on the, you know, actual issue, but how exactly does one overcount a population? Because I would assume that undercounting is just, you know, people don't participate in the census. Is overcounting literally just they say they have more people in their household than they actually do?
Or? Well, from having seen a census form, I would say there are a couple of ways at least that can happen.
Okay.
One is, for example, they asked me when my mother-in-law was living with me, kind of, how many people are physically in the house now?
Mm.
Now, at the time, she was visiting in China.
Okay.
So that makes it tricky. Is she living with me because she's living with me, or is she actually not living with me because she isn't literally present in the house while I'm filling out the form? She's not sleeping in the house. Now, if my mother-in-law was white instead of Chinese, it's like you can see how that could happen. I might get a census form at my address and say, yeah, my mother-in-law lives with me. At the same time, maybe she's at a vacation house in Florida where she also gets a census form and says, yeah, I'm living here.
Ah, okay.
So that's one way it happens.
Sure.
Another way is you know, simply miscalculating. I don't think people deliberately cheat on the census. But
right.
The way the questions are framed sometimes leaves a certain amount of opportunity for misinterpretation.
Yeah.
And then, of course, undercounting, in a sense, results in overcounting,
at least
relatively. So, for example, with the citizenship question, there may have been a lot of illegal immigrants or people who have overstayed visas who was like, well, geez, if I say that I'm here on the census, are they going to come and deport me? It's
right.
Like, no, that doesn't happen. But now that the question has been put out in the wind by the Trump people, the fear is raised. So these people, even if they got a census form, even if they would have originally been willing to fill it out, like, maybe not worth it, not worth it. But the Constitution, I mean, this was the debate at the time. The Constitution is really very clear. It doesn't talk about the number of citizens. It talks about the number of people.
Yeah, people. Okay, so, interesting.
You know, so, if you want to be an originalist, that is an original.
So it really is that it's not the way that they were, that the Trump administration was able to stack the deck was that they didn't tell people to undercount or overcount or this sort of thing, because that happens anyway.
Right.
It was just that they didn't do their due diligence in checking and rechecking and cross-referencing their results with the, you know, other counts that are done inside the states.
And created some scare tactics like citizenship. And if you're not a citizen, I mean, it's kind of like a subtle method of voter suppression is to put a billboard saying, you know, that voter fraud is a felony.
Yeah.
And they're not saying that you're committing a felony. Just be careful you don't commit a felony.
Huh.
That's voter suppression. So they do that in minority neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, criminals are subtle.
Yet more evidence that Trump was incompetent. Well, not incompetent, was malicious, actively malicious in this case.
Our next story is from Reuters. Ukraine to halt key Russian gas transit to Europe blames Moscow. Ukraine said on Tuesday it would suspend the flow of gas through a transit point, which it said delivers almost a third of the fuel piped from Russia to Europe through Ukraine, blaming Moscow for the move and saying it would move the flows elsewhere. Ukraine has remained a major transit route for Russian gas in Europe, even after Moscow's invasion. GTSOU, which is the company that operates Ukraine's gas system, said it would stop shipments via the Sokhranov. That the Ukrainian place, on Wednesday, declaring force majeure, a clause invoked when a business is hit by something beyond its control. Sakhranivka? Maybe. But Gazprom, which has a monopoly on Russian gas exports by pipeline, said it was technologically impossible to shift all volumes to the Sudja interconnection point further west, as GTSOU proposed. The CEO of GTSOU, Sergei Mikogin, told Reuters that Russian occupying forces had started taking, in other words, siphoning gas, transiting through Ukraine and sending it to two Russian-backed separatist regions in the country's east, but did not cite evidence. So the issue here, essentially, the headline, and you've seen maybe several of these headlines, it makes it sound like Ukraine is cutting off Russian gas, cutting off its nose to spite its face, forcing its Western allies to stop using Russian gas. It's not like that. Essentially, the Russians are messing with the Ukrainian pipeline system. The Ukrainians want to send it to a more secure system for sending the gas into Europe. And the Russians are saying, oh, no, this is the Ukrainians' fault, when, you know, it's kind of like stealing cable. They're stealing gas. For our last story today, this is from Live Science several weeks ago. Nuclear fusion is one step closer with new AI breakthrough. The green energy revolution promised by nuclear fusion is now a step closer thanks to the first successful use of a cutting-edge artificial intelligence system to shape the superheated hydrogen plasmas inside a fusion reactor. The successful trial indicates that the use of AI could be a breakthrough in the long-running search for electricity generated from nuclear fusion, bringing its introduction to replace fossil fuels and nuclear fission on modern power grids tantalizingly closer. The reactor coils are usually governed by a set of independent computerized controllers, but the new AI system was able to manipulate plasma with a single controller. The donut-shaped fusion reactor is the type that seems most promising for controlling nuclear fusion. A tokamak design, originally a Russian design, is being used for the massive international ITER, I-T-E-R, the way in Latin, project being built in France, and some proponents think they'll have a tokamak in commercial operation as soon as 2030. I will mention that over the course of my life, science fiction-like advantages like flat-screen TVs have always been 10 years away, and sooner or later, they're typically right. Time will tell. I might even still be here to tell it.
I hope you are, and I hope I am too.
Thank you. And, of course, good luck. Okay, that's all there is time for today. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT HD2. My co-host, indispensable editor, occasional mouthpiece, and frequent clock watcher is Andrew Ferguson. Thank you, Andrew. We'll look forward to seeing you again next week. Hope you've enjoyed the show, and hope we'll be able to share more information with you next time. Take care.
See you later.
Too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. We're moving closer to the shore. I know we'll be there by tomorrow. And we'll escape.
Greetings, KPFT listeners. This is DJ Metalord, host of Sweet Nightmares Radio Show. Sweet Nightmares Radio Show has been supporting the metal underground and everything in between, from the classics to the newest releases, since 1987. You can catch the show every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. on the FM band. Also, listen to an encore presentation every Saturday. Yes, every Saturday, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on the HD2 channel. Sweet Nightmares, only on 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Charles Hightower, host of the R&B Gold Show, 6 p.m. till 8, right here on KPFT, Houston's Community Station. I'll be moving and grooving with all the good classic soul just for you on KPFT FM and FM HD1 Houston.
I'm Robin from the membership department here at KPFT. I'm here with Julianne Malvo.
Robin, we've had the kind of conversations that you don't hear many other places. There are lots of media outlets, not as many that are as profound and pointed as the Pacifica stations. We talk about politics, we talk about race, and we talk about gender. We also talk about you and what's on your mind. Please join KPFT. The number is 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738.
Thank you, Dr. Malvo. Julianne Malvo live Monday mornings at 8 a.m. It's easy to make your donation to KPFT. Either call 713-526-5738 and do it on the phone, or visit kpft.org and donate safely and securely online. 713-526-5738 or online at kpft.org. We hope to see